Matthew chapter 28. Jesus of Nazareth has passed through death into resurrection life. He has opened a way through death for all people to follow him. He is the first fruits, the first crop of a great harvest from the dead. Because he has been raised from the dead to physical life beyond the grave, anyone today who puts their trust in him will also one day be raised to immortal physical life. Throughout history, the human race has made many attempts to preserve the dead. The ancient Egyptians are famous for the care with which they treated those who had died. The discovery in the 1970s of the grave of the Emperor Qin in China with the terracotta army of soldiers shows that others too tried to equip the dead for life beyond the grave. But preserving the dead isn't something only done in the distant past. Some of the most infamous leaders of the 20th century had their bodies embalmed so that even in a very limited sense, they might live on after they had died. Lenin, Chairman Mao, the Vietnamese leader Ho Chi Minh, all underwent this treatment. Their bodily fluids were drained and replaced with chemical preservatives. And not far from where we're sitting tonight at University College in the South Cloisters, you can see the preserved remains of the 18th century philosopher Jeremy Bentham. Bentham left instructions that after he died, his body should be dissected and then preserved. Unfortunately for him, the mummification of his head went wrong, and he now has a wax replacement. It is said that in 2013, his body was taken to a meeting of the college council where he was recorded in the minutes as present but not voting. A modern attempt to preserve the dead is cryogenic preservation. Although it doesn't seem to be as popular now as it was a few years ago, a number of facilities around the world still exist to freeze and preserve the bodies of the dead, in the hope that one day when cures have been found for currently incurable diseases, the bodies of the dead can be thawed out like some giant frozen chicken and eventually be brought back to life. While such approaches at least take physical bodily life seriously, their goal is so limited. The best they aim at is resuscitating the dead. The hope is merely to bring the person back to life. The very best they aim for is merely to continue the existence of a life in the form that it was in when it died. So the 80-year-old who died will be brought back with all the physical limitations of an 80-year-old body. What we celebrate as having happened on Easter Sunday is of a different order entirely. Resurrection is not about Jesus coming back to life. Jesus did not come back to life, if by that we mean he returned to the same kind of existence he had before he was crucified. Jesus did not come back to life in order to die again. He passed through death and came out the other side into resurrection life. Never to die again. Throughout the world, Christians believe that today, Jesus Christ is living a physical, bodily life beyond the reach of suffering and death, and that he offers that kind of life to everyone today who will follow him. When you stand at the graveside, perhaps, and you hear the handful of soil clatter down on top of the coffin, or you watch the curtains close at the crematorium, it does seem as if death has spoken the final word on somebody's life. Life has come to an end. Death, it seems, has claimed one more victim, and the natural order of things has taken its course. And as we come to Matthew chapter 28 this evening, it seemed very much that death had spoken the final word on Jesus. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, had been there when he died. Matthew 27, verse 56 tells us. And a few lines later, we're told that they were there, verse 61, sitting opposite the tomb, watching as Joseph of Arimathea, a follower of Jesus, claims Jesus' body from Pilate and buries it in his own new tomb. And not only had Jesus been declared dead, but every earthly effort had been made to secure the grave. So the religious leaders remembered what Jesus had said, that he would rise again. And afraid that his disciples would hide the body and pretend that that had happened, the stone that had been rolled across the grave was made secure with a seal. And a guard of Roman soldiers was posted at the front. Every earthly effort was made to lock it down. Nobody was to get in or out. So Matthew 28, verse 1. After the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. Matthew doesn't mention that they took spices to anoint the body. Mark tells us that, but Matthew's more interested in telling us what the women saw. They'd seen Jesus die. They'd seen his burial. Now they've come to see the tomb. But Matthew makes the point, when they got there, they were too late. Verse 2, there was a violent earthquake. For an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning. His clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. Well, the guards, they were probably no strangers to difficult or dangerous situations. And surely their duty that weekend must have been the easiest duty they had ever been given. It turned out to be an impossible job for them. Stop a handful of frightened civilians from stealing a dead body from a sealed tomb. But they couldn't keep the body in the grave. Jesus had died. The natural order of things had seemed to have run its course. Every earthly effort was made to keep Jesus in the tomb. It seemed beyond doubt that the final word had been spoken on Jesus. But the truth is, heaven was shaking up the old order, and a new order of things was beginning. In the Bible, earthquakes come at moments of divine judgment. So in the previous chapter, when Jesus dies on the cross, there is an earthquake. And now, as heaven declares that Jesus is righteous, that he has paid for our sins, Matthew says in verse 2, there was a violent earthquake. Because an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, flicked the stone away. Matthew tells us it was at dawn on the first day of the week that it happened. Just as God commanded the light to shine into the darkness on the first day of creation, so now on the first day of this new creation, a new kind of human existence is beginning. Resurrection life was coming into the world, and the darkness of death could not resist it and will never be able to resist it. To the women, though, it must have seemed like that gravestone was the end, a great full stop to the life of Jesus. But the stone that was supposed to keep Jesus in was nothing to this messenger from heaven. Going to the tomb, he rolled back the stone and sat on it. I love that verse. He sat on it. I suppose he had to sit somewhere while he waited for the women to arrive. But doesn't it speak of the victory over death? He rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him, they shook and became like dead men. And quite right that they did. The guards were agents of the old order. They should have been afraid. They were part of the rebellion. They were part of the futility of earth as it stands against Jesus, against the God of heaven. And all of us, naturally, are born into that futility and into that rebellion. We are part of that old order by birth, setting ourselves up against Jesus and his resurrection. But the resurrection of Jesus calls time on that old order. Its days are numbered. The new creation is breaking in. And in contrast to the guards, the women have no reason to fear. They were on the side of Jesus. Look down at verse 5. The angel comforts them. Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. The reason the women shouldn't be frightened is because they're on the side of the crucified, risen Jesus. As glorious as this angel was, Hebrews 1:14 tells us that all angels are ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation. The women have come from earth. The angel has come from heaven. But they're united in their love and service of Jesus. Those who have not made peace with God in this life should be frightened. They will be frightened when the graves eventually burst open and they're confronted with the angels of God in the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ. But those who have trusted in Jesus in this life have nothing to be afraid of. They've begun to taste the future resurrection life, even now. Well, the angel was so excited. He wants the women to inspect the tomb. You can imagine him jumping off his stone armchair. He's so excited to give them the guided tour. He's not here, the angel says. He's risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he's risen from the dead. He's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him. Now I've told you, the angel said. My job is done. Jesus had promised again and again that after he had been put to death, he would be raised to life. Matthew 16, Matthew 17, Matthew 20. He had promised that death would not be the end for him. He would have the final word. The teachers of the law, at least, were aware of what he'd said. That's why they tried to lock down the grave. The disciples, though, had run away. Only these women had faith to come, at least to see the grave. You know, it's often been pointed out that if these resurrection accounts in the Gospels were made up, you probably wouldn't have given such a prominent role to women in the first century. But in Matthew's Gospel, it's the women who are there at all the key moments. They see the crucifixion, they see the burial, they see the empty tomb, and very soon they'll be the first ones to see the risen Jesus. There are eyewitnesses. There is evidence. That's why we're running the School of Faith that Hannah mentioned a few moments ago in the notices a week tomorrow, with these TED Talk style presentations exploring questions about the Christian faith. We can investigate it. There is evidence to consider, eyewitness accounts to contend with. So do have a word with Rico Tice after the service. He'll be standing at the back. He'd love to give you one of these flyers and give you more information. But it's 7 o'clock a week tomorrow, and you'd be very welcome to come or come with a friend and investigate some more. It's the women here who are the witnesses. It's the women who are given the job of telling the apostles what has happened. And they don't need to be told twice. Verse 8. So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid still, but now also filled with joy. And they ran to tell his disciples. Well, they probably don't get far. Verse 9. Suddenly, Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. Greetings. Seems a bit tame. Be well. It's the normal form of address when people met. But doesn't it seem a little bit tame, given that he's the first person to pass through death into resurrection life? Hello. Hello from the new creation. I guess, what else could he say? But as the women look at Jesus, they see their own future facing them, and a warm welcome awaits them. Greetings. Well, the women do the only thing they can do. They come to him and clasp his feet and worship him. Do not be afraid, he says. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they'll see me. It's the women Jesus appears to first. It's the disciples the women are to find. Again, I wonder if we had written this, if we had made this up, I wonder if we would have thought that the women should be the first, the disciples should be the second. For dramatic effect, wouldn't we have sent Jesus, or at least the women, to Pilate or to the chief priests? That would have been a fun scene to write, wouldn't it? Imagine writing that scene when those who put Jesus to death are confronted by the evidence. But Jesus doesn't bother with them. The story's moved on. As far as Jesus is concerned, the important ones are those who've trusted in him. Even though they deserted him, he still calls them his brothers. Those who looked important, the religious leaders, the movers and shakers in society, the Roman authorities, it's as if they're no longer relevant to the story. They've been left behind. In verses 11 to 15, we find them still living in the past, fiddling around in the shadows with lies about the disciples stealing Jesus' body. Faced with the most wonderful news in history, what do? They try and cover it up. They pass money across in brown envelopes. It's the only language they understand. They're completely oblivious to the fact that the story has moved on and they've been left behind. Well, it ought to be a warning, I think, to us. I met a man once from one of the many cults there are in London. He was out on the street engaging people in conversation. And he said to me, "Oh, we respect Jesus. We respect Jesus in our group. There's room for Jesus in our teaching." But that's the problem. Jesus doesn't fit into anybody else's teaching. He was raised from the dead to immortal life. And the question isn't whether he fits into our lives or matches up with our values and opinions. The question is whether we fit into his. A new day has dawned with the resurrection of Jesus. And our lives, Matthew says, are only relevant as we've taken account of it. We may try and live as if it hasn't happened, but that doesn't change the fact that it has happened. And the implications go worldwide. That, I think, is why Matthew mentions Galilee as we come to an end tonight. Did you see it in verse 7 as the angel instructs the women, go quickly and tell his disciples he's risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him. And Jesus says the same to the women in verse 10. He says to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they'll see me. Well, why Galilee? Some critics have suggested that Matthew only knew about Jesus' appearances in Galilee, that he didn't know that Jesus appeared earlier in Jerusalem, the events that are recorded in Luke's Gospel and John's Gospel. But that can't be right, because Matthew was one of the disciples, and he was there when Jesus appeared. And in verse 10, he actually has an appearance of Jesus in the vicinity of Jerusalem. It's not that Matthew's gospel contradicts the other gospels. Each has a particular focus. And for Matthew, Galilee is the climax of his account. Matthew begins his gospel introducing us to Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Jesus is the one from the royal line of David, the one with all authority in heaven and on earth. As the son of Abraham, he's the one through whom all peoples on earth will be blessed. In Matthew chapter 4, Jesus' ministry begins in Galilee. It was an area in the north of Judea populated by Jews and Gentiles, non-Jews. It was called Galilee of the Gentiles. And throughout Matthew's gospel, there's a growing theme of the gathering in of the Gentiles, the outsiders. The resurrected Jesus made a number of appearances in Jerusalem, and Matthew knows about them. But his climax is Galilee, because Galilee represents the nations. In Matthew's account, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead is the greatest event in the history of the world. And the whole world needs to hear about it, Matthew says. So those today who thought they could destroy the church with bombs and explosives, as they did in Sri Lanka, as they tried to do there, they are standing on the wrong side of Easter. You know, we might feel in the West here as if we're on a tiny island of Christian faith and the tide is coming in and the sand is getting washed away and the island is shrinking. Do you feel like that sometimes? One writer comments that we shouldn't mourn the fact that the West is post-Christian without at the same time rejoicing that the church is now post-Western. Taken in a global context, it's not Christians who are on this shrinking island. Earlier this year, I visited India, and 7 hours from the nearest city in the tiny rural village was a church of 800 Christians. 10 years ago, there wasn't a single Christian in the village. They are there because Jesus was raised from the dead and is alive. And we don't say that in a triumphalistic way, because tremendous growth of the church is accompanied by tremendous opposition and persecution around the world. And this year, India joined the top 10 most persecuted countries, according to Open Doors watch list. But today in China, more Christians will have met in church than in all of so-called Christian Europe. And while the government in China is launching a new chapter of religious persecution, more Christians will have met today in China than the total membership of the Communist Party. Mark Knoll, an American church historian, notes that today more Anglicans attended church in each of Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda than the number of Anglicans in Britain, America, and Canada combined. Nearly half the Christians who have ever lived are alive today. And while some of this, of course, is the result of population growth, much of it also arises from the remarkable growth of the church in Asia and Latin America and Africa. And the resurrection of Jesus is the cause. There is no other explanation. Charles Mole, the Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at Cambridge, who died a few years ago, put it like this. If the coming into existence of the church rips a great hole in history, a hole the size and shape of the resurrection, what does the secular historian propose to stop it up with? In other words, what other explanation is there? That's the significance of Galilee, Matthew says. Well, I wonder if we have grasped what happened that first Easter Sunday. What happened to him established our future. If we know that Jesus died and was raised again from the dead and now lives beyond the reach of death ever again, then we will know that there's nothing else really for us to fear anymore. The resurrection of Jesus from the dead means that if we put our trust in him, when he returns to earth and calls us out of our graves, then our lives will really begin as they were always meant to be. Think of all the troubles in this world today. Think of all the problems that you are facing in your life, in your family, all the heartaches, all the pains, all the sadnesses, perhaps that you've experienced since last Easter. They might sometimes seem to overwhelm us. And yet, when we grasp what our future is in the risen Jesus Christ, the Bible tells us that even the heaviest troubles can seem light and passing. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. We've sung it already tonight. Jesus has overturned the old order. God, as it were, has planted his flag in enemy-occupied territory. What has happened is irreversible. The future is certain. It's begun in Jesus. Jesus didn't merely come back from the dead. He went through death into resurrection life. And where he has gone, all those who love him will follow him one day. So as the angel said, do not be afraid. He has risen. Just as he said, he is going ahead of you, and there you will see him. Let's have a moment of quiet as we each respond to God's word tonight. And then the band will come and join us on the platform and we'll sing our response.